Hello, everyone. My name is Bruce McConnell, Global Vice President of the East-West Institute. Welcome to another episode of the EWI Podcast, a platform where we explore some of today's key global issues with leading thinkers and analysts. Today, I have the pleasure of welcoming Michael Daniel, who's the president of the Cyber Threat Alliance. Michael, welcome to the EWI Podcast.
Thanks for having me.
Prior to joining the CTA, Michael served as the Special Assistant to President Obama and Cybersecurity Coordinator on the National Security Council staff, where part of his role was to develop national cybersecurity strategy and also ensure the U.S. government worked effectively with other countries on cybersecurity issues. And this brings us to today's topic, examining how governments and the private sector can work together to respond to cyber incidents and threats. So to begin with, how are private companies handling cyber threats, and how does their approaches relate to government's responses?
Well, Bruce, I think when you look at the landscape that you're talking about, you actually have to start to differentiate what companies you're talking about. So if you're talking about your standard end users that are not the five largest banks or the largest healthcare companies, many of them are actually struggling to figure out what to do. And I think that's why we actually really need to, as a matter of policy, as a matter of approach within this area, start to differentiate what we expect of, say, a major telecommunications company, a major cybersecurity company, versus what we expect of a mid-size retailer.
Well, but what do we expect? I mean, there's very little expectation out there that's laid out for companies except in a few highly regulated, traditionally regulated sectors. The rest of the companies, perhaps it's a little different in Europe, but are pretty much on their own in terms of what they think they're supposed to do.
That's true. And I think that's something that we actually need to change, and that we need to get a lot more clear about what those expectations are. I think that in many cases, we've been expecting simultaneously too little and too much of companies. Too little in the sense that we've allowed sort of this almost fatalistic idea to start to take root, that I've started to call it the I give up syndrome, right? That it's completely impossible to deal with. And then on the other hand, we've been promoting practices and information sharing and trying to get every company in the United States to be able to, you know, deal with what an MD5 hash is and why they should care about it. And that's equally ridiculous. And so what I think we need to start doing is taking much more of that risk management approach and the same kind of approach that we ask of companies in the legal sphere. We don't ask every company to be an expert in law. That's why they have outside counsel, or they bring in a general counsel, right, that then accesses that. And I think we need to move to much more of that same kind of approach of where we expect our companies to have a certain degree of capacity, but then that they're relying on other entities in order to deal with those cyber threats.
It's certainly true that it's hard even for the experts to stay experts. So to
Yes.
expect people who are trying to run a business of any size up to the highest levels to understand the ins and outs of cybersecurity is really unrealistic. So we're talking a little bit about the government and it perhaps making clearer what the expectations might be for some of the larger companies especially. But how does that relationship work? How does the relationship between the government work in the U.S., for example, between the various parts of the government, some of whom are defenders, others of whom are regulators, and the cybersecurity industry?
So it's a very strange relationship. In many ways, we don't even know what to call it. The relationship between the government and the cybersecurity industry is not a traditional regulatory one. So that doesn't really work. The government is not necessarily buying, although it buys cybersecurity services, right? In the cases that we're talking about here, the government is not procuring those cybersecurity services. So it's not a traditional transactional relationship. So we don't even have the vocabulary to talk about what this relationship really is. And I think that's actually one of our problems of, we refer to it as like public-private partnership and other consultant words that don't really have a clear sort of meaning. And I actually think that that is one of the things that we need to build. The institutions, the relationships, those structures to enable the government and the cybersecurity industry and the other elements of the ecosystem that can actually do something in response to cyber threats at scale. I think we actually need to build those relationships out. And I don't necessarily mean that they have to be formalized in law or something like that, but we have to have a better understanding of those structures that can be repeated over time, that are not completely dependent on individual personalities being involved, that they can evolve and adapt as the situation changes. And I think that is one of our key challenges in this sort of threat incident response space right now.
So that's certainly true in the U.S. Obviously, in other countries, the relationship between government and industry is different. It's also different in that most of the great cybersecurity companies are still American companies. But what are you seeing in terms of cooperation internationally, both among companies and between governments and companies, given that cybersecurity and cyberspace doesn't respect traditional national borders?
I think you're starting to see a lot of that grow. Within the Cyber Threat Alliance that I run now, which is a nonprofit dedicated to enabling cybersecurity companies to share threat intelligence at speed at scale, we have many international members, so they're not all just US-based companies. And we're working on actually enabling CTA to cooperate and figure out how to share information with governments around the world. And you can see governments working on that ability to do that kind of interchange. And I think that there's a growing both demand and awareness that we're going to have to do that. And probably in some countries, it's actually easier for them to recognize that because the US government is used to being so big that it can, and operating at such a scale that it can often operate independently. Other countries that are smaller haven't had that luxury. Or that advantage. And so they've really started to come to this realization, I think, fairly rapidly.
That's interesting. Of course, governments are a mixed bag, really, when you're out there trying to promote cybersecurity, because governments are also the source of attacks. And also, we've seen recently, obviously, that government identified vulnerabilities or cyber weapons have been released into the wild. So how positive is the overall contribution of government these days to the International Cybersecurity Forum?
So I actually think overall it is positive. And ultimately, I think that we as societies, we have always assigned a security role to governments. Almost every society assigns that function to their government. And I don't think that's going to go away anytime soon. And so I think that the governments are going to become more involved in that process. I also think that the part of what we're also trying to do is set the norms of behavior that we expect, because I think it is unrealistic to expect that governments will stop doing espionage. As President Obama acknowledged, all nations conduct espionage and they use cyber means to do it. The question is, how do you enable governments to pursue their legitimate national security interest in a way that doesn't cause destabilization, right? And enable us to have the rules and the structures in place to sort of contain that behavior. That's one thing. The other aspect of it that I would argue is that when you look at the vast majority of malicious behavior in cyberspace, the amount of activity that's generated by the criminal organizations far outstrips anything that governments do. And so there's, in fact, actually this huge amount of shared interest, space for shared interest in going after and really disrupting those criminal actors. There are some estimates that are showing that the level of criminal activity has reached the point where it actually outstrips the GDP of all but a handful of the largest economies on the planet. That's not really a tenable place for us to be. I think instead that that's actually becoming a threat to the stability of cyberspace and the utility of cyberspace as well. And so governments are going to really have to work together with the private sector to address those concerns.
Right. So those concerns, cybercrime or cyber organized crime, if you will, which is now, as you say, a huge business globally, and the proceeds of which are used to fund other criminal activities like drug trafficking and human trafficking. So it really is a scourge. Not just on the internet, but on the planet. There's a lot of different elements to that, right? So there's the kind of defending your systems and pushing people back out of them or protecting them. That's something that is really done kind of at an operational level. And then there is the trying to find the criminals, the investigation part, and then it's finding out, because they all live somewhere, it's getting the home government, host government. Many of these criminals hang out in parts of former Soviet Union, Eastern Europe. And so getting those governments to cooperate and do the right thing. So what would you say in terms of those different tasks are the ones that are more tractable and the ones that are going to take us longer to get done?
I think there's actually another element that I would layer in there, which is in between those two. Yes, we need to do better at just protecting and doing defense in depth and cyber resilience on the systems. But I also think that we can take the fight to the bad guys much more effectively, that there are concepts out there that CTA is exploring, that others are exploring. For example, the idea of adversary playbooks. So if you start to understand how the criminals are doing their activity, not just the particular of using this IP address to launch a DDoS attack, but from beginning to end, here's how their operations fit together. And here's the different plays that they're running against the healthcare industry or the financial industry or against individuals. And you start looking for the places where they are the most vulnerable to disruption. What are the tools or tactics or techniques that they're using that are the most amenable to being disrupted by something that the defenders can do that will impose the greatest cost on them, that's the most expensive thing for them to replace? If we can start raising the cost on the criminals, it will actually make that whole business line much less lucrative. And we've got to think about it in those economic terms, that if we can start upending their economic model, that's how we can start to put pressure on them. Then you can actually move to the, okay, and then how do you actually start to extend that into the physical world and get the agreements to actually go after the criminals using the information from cyberspace and those activities to go after the criminals in the physical world? That will take a lot longer, and I think will require creating incentives for those countries that are harboring those criminals. They're obviously gaining some benefit from it, or they perceive that they are. And how do we change that diplomatic equation, that economic equation for them to make it less beneficial to harbor those individuals?
So this question about how do you raise the cost for the attacker, in this case the attacker being a criminal entity or someone who's hired a criminal entity to do something else for them, still criminals, how do you raise the cost for them in addition to just making it harder to get in? Is this about hacking back, for example, and shutting things down? How does that work?
So anybody who's heard me talk for any length of time knows that I'm take a very dim view of the idea of private sector hackback. I think that's a terrible idea. I think it's a recipe for disaster on multiple levels. But that doesn't mean that you have to sort of just stand there and take it. As I was laying out, there's also different degrees of what on your network means. If you are an end user, yes, that's a very defined thing. If you're a telecommunications company, that's a little bit of a different thing. If you're a major cloud service provider, that's a different thing. And so how do we actually enable those pieces of our ecosystem that own and operate large parts of that ecosystem to be able to take action on their own networks, on their own equipment, but that is still more disruptive to the adversaries? And I suspect in most cases that's not an issue of technical capacity. It's an issue of liability concerns. Mm-hmm. It's an issue of policy. It's an issue of law. And what actions do we want to authorize those entities to take? And then what as societies are we willing to indemnify them for? And those are all policy discussions that we have that I think would enable us to, without even getting to the point of, you know, reaching all the way back out to wherever the bad guys are on whatever box they happen to be operating on, without even getting to that point, we could impose a much greater degree of disruption on their activities if we can get ourselves organized more effectively in that way. And then another way to think about it is also, again, drawing out this playbook idea of, if you start to see that a lot of the criminal organizations are using similar kinds of tools and you can trace back where those tools are coming from, can you in effect interdict their supply lines? Can you break that chain of where they're getting and disrupt where they're getting their malware from, for example? Those things will always regenerate themselves. That's the nature of those activities. But if you can knock it back for 3 or 4 months, that's probably still that's still worth it. And if you can do that at a scale that matters, then you can start to impose those kinds of costs. And so a lot of this, what's interesting to me about a lot of this is none of this is, from a technical standpoint, incredibly difficult. The difficulties, as usual, are all on the, quote, soft stuff. It's the diplomatic issues, the legal and liability issues. That's where all the hard problems are in this space.
So, in particular, I was interested in your point about the network service providers, internet service providers, and what they could do to help protect their customers, obviously, and to help protect their own operating networks. And some of that, as you suggest, might require them to disrupt service temporarily for some customers, to block some things. And so therefore, they are afraid, as we know, of being liable. What happened to my mail? I missed this deal because the mail didn't come in while we were blocking it for the greater good. And so is that the kind of thing you're talking about where we might be able to indemnify them?
I would say that I don't know that I have a position on the specific example that you raised, but yes, that's exactly the kind of thing I think we need to have larger policy discussions about. And particularly if we're also talking about those service providers doing that at the behest of a government, you know, again, what kind of rules are we going to put on? What can governments ask to be blocked? Because what the U.S. government would like to be blocked is very different than what, say, the Chinese, the Iranians, or the Russian government might like to be blocked. Right. And so how do we, again, do that in a way that's respectful of our norms and that within the United States, at least, is respectful of our broader constitution and laws? But I think the fact that we have to work through those questions doesn't mean that we shouldn't or there couldn't be benefit and that there's more room for maneuver than what we've got right now.
In another podcast, we're talking to Peter Altabef, co-chair of the Moonshot Project of the National Security Telecommunications Advisory Committee, which is attempting to figure out what we need to do to make the internet safe and secure in 2028. And this is an area where I know they're looking at these questions. What about the other side of it? So there's things that we should protect the companies from. Are there things that we should put a little bit more pressure on them in terms of making better products, making safer services? Should there be a private right of action against companies who fail to perform at a certain level of cybersecurity?
I think that's almost inevitably where we're going. When I talk to CEOs and boards and other executives in any industry, one of the things I tell them is that you have two choices. You can either help shape the standard of care for cybersecurity in your industry, or you can have it imposed on you by the courts. Because I don't think that it's going to be tenable in most industries for the current situation to continue. I mean, and some of that is just driven by public safety, right? I mean, it's one thing if your spreadsheet crashes, it's another if your pacemaker does. So I think that just the inevitable sort of marrying of the physical world with the cyber world through the Internet of Things is going to drive some of that, whether anybody likes it or not. So the question in my mind is, how do we shape that in a way that is most beneficial to producing a more secure outcome down the road? Some of this is going to be very hard. You have the economics of general purpose computing devices, which says that the cheapest thing to do is use a general purpose computing device, which by definition is general. So therefore, it's very difficult to constrain its functionality. So the economics of that are going to be fighting against the needs of security. So I think that this is going to be a difficult problem for us. But I think that using the tools of insurance and liability and, you know, both imposing liability and for, you know, negligence, if you will, and providing liability protection for good behavior and other things, those are all going to be elements of, and setting up those standards of care is all going to be elements of the solution.
So the Cyber Threat Alliance is really a unique partnership among companies. And as you say, it's mostly American companies, but you have a number of international companies. Are there other things being like that being organized elsewhere in the world? I was talking to some Chinese colleagues the other day, and it sounds like there's a kind of association of domestic cybersecurity companies that's starting to get together and cooperating with each other and with the government, of course, on cyber threats.
So I haven't seen anything that is at the scale that CTA is trying to do or with the formality that CTA has put into it. And I think that's one of the lessons that we actually learned and that our member companies learned. I mean, the way that the Cyber Threat Alliance got started was from an informal partnership among four of our founding members. And they very quickly discovered that if they really wanted to take it to a scale where it could have the kind of impact that they could see that it could have, they needed to put some formal structure around it. And it turns out that that's actually a challenge to do and to do well. I've been joking with people that we've figured out why we've spent 30 years talking about information sharing instead of doing it is because it turns out doing it is actually kind of hard. But I think that this may sound strange, but I don't see it as a competitive thing. I actually would want there to be a development of organizations that are trying to spur this same kind of activity and allow for this interconnection and this interchange to happen, because it's going to be the only way that we can get ahead of how the threat is evolving.
Yeah, absolutely. It takes a village. As you say, it's easy to talk about information sharing, but harder to do it. One of the ways that information sharing has traditionally gone on well in our community is that the real security operators know each other. It's a personal trust thing, these circles of trust. And certainly my experience when I was at Homeland Security is that they don't want to be formalized. The way this works is we just know each other and we help each other out. And if you try to put bureaucracy on this, it's going to kill it.
So I think that there is some truth to that. And one of the things that CTA works very hard at doing is building up that trust among our members. And we have been working on various ways of how do you get people together, both in person and virtually? How do you establish those connections during normal times so that when something bad happens, you've got that reservoir of trust to draw on? And it's certainly not our intention to make it overly formal. But I do think that we need to get to a point where it's not completely dependent on the individual personalities involved and who knows who. Who's on whose Rolodex? Maybe some of your podcast listeners don't even know what a Rolodex is anymore. But, you know, who's in the contacts file, right? You know, I think that that's going to be incredibly important to do, because as this continues to grow, just relying on those individual relationships is going to be insufficient. And I think that you will never get away from the need for human-to-human interaction. That has certainly been one of the lessons that we have seen, even just in the first 18 months of CTA operating, is that the automated sharing that we do is really important, but the human-to-human interaction is equally as important. And so that is now really becoming a much more important part of our mission is, and we see it as kind of a dual mission, really, of both the automated sharing and that human-to-human sharing. You have to have both in order to do it really well.
So Andy Greenberg in Wired recently wrote a really good summary of the NotPetya attack, which took down the Maersk shipping company, and many other companies were affected, of course. But just what it took for them to recover from that and how lucky they were that there had been a power outage in Ghana, so they actually had one remaining map of their network that they could reconfigure the network from. So in the ideal world, if the Cyber Threat Alliance were really doing its job and whatnot, how would the response to NotPetya be different?
So I think that what I would say is that it should be faster and more effective, that the Cyber Threat Alliance should serve as a force multiplier for the entities that can actually take action to stop the spread of something like NotPetya, that it can enable more governments to connect together and to take coordinated action. So I think that that's what we're building towards with CTA. And we're really exploring this idea of what does that operational collaboration environment look like? What does that actually mean? When you have a global threat like that, how do you actually get organized? Who needs to be in the room? How do you have that self-organization happen? And how do you have those relationships built out ahead of time? Because mm-hmm. you cannot be exchanging business cards during the crisis. That does not work. So how do you actually build all of that in advance and keep it warm so that it's available for you when you have those crisis events? And I think some of that is actually us also starting to understand who in the ecosystem really does have the capacity to take action that can protect a very large number of people in a short period of time, and to take action to disrupt whatever that threat is in a fairly short period of time, and do it in a way that causes as minimal disruption to the rest of what's going on in cyberspace and the internet. And I think that that is going to be a very interesting exploration. And it is likely to involve multiple private sector actors and governments, because a lot of the capabilities and the networks, frankly, are resident in the private sector. And so this is not something that either one of those sectors can do by themselves.
Yeah, no, so quarantining people or other things like that is going to be a public-private operation in a variety of ways. Before we close the show, I'd like again to thank Michael Daniel for joining us and sharing his insights on international and domestic cyber cooperation, public-private, and the response to cyber incidents and cyber threats. Michael, thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Bruce. Thank you for having me.
Remember to look for EWI Podcast on our website, SoundCloud, and iTunes under the name of East West Institute, where you can listen, follow, and subscribe so you won't miss our conversations. Thank you for listening.